Everyone, thank you for taking the time and lending your ears to these various conversations. Very excited to share all the guests that I have with you this season. And in order for this season to be a success, I need you guys to help share the word and spread the love of the What Makes You Tick pod. While you're listening, please take a moment to like or subscribe to the podcast wherever you are. And as always, I really appreciate all the help and the support that you guys have given me in the last four seasons. Let's hopefully make this one the best.
Then we had a reduction, which is quite traumatic in itself, right? You've sort of waited sort of two and a half years, whatever it might be, to get that goal. You have three, you have to remove one. And then we went away on what was supposed to be our sort of last big holiday before they arrived. And it was sort of like maybe like, you know, 19 weeks, 20, 21 weeks and that. And we landed in Kuala Lumpur within sort of 16 hours. We'd lost both and that was it, right?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to What Makes You Tick. And I'm delighted to be joined by a former international rugby player who played for England. We won't hold that against them, but he played in at the highest level, over 60 caps for his country. He has over 300 caps for clubs that he's played with: Newcastle, Leicester, Toulouse, and finishing off his professional career in Newcastle. This gentleman has, between all competitions, over 2,500 points, which is phenomenal. I was very lucky to score a couple of tries. To say 2,500 points in your CV is fantastic. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the podcast, Toby Flood. How's it going, Toby?
I'm all right, thank you. How are you?
Good, good, good. Thanks for joining me, pal. No worries. I forgot to mention as well there that you're obviously a father and a son, and you have a lovely wife and family as well. We can't let them left out. No. How's all the crew?
They're good, thank you. They're good. They're hectic, you know. They're in their early stages of childhood, so life is a battle, but we're getting there. You know, my sleepless nights, all that sort of stuff. But we're good. We're sort of slowly crawling out the other side.
Good man, good man. Good to hear. So, Toby, listen, I'm delighted you joined me. I suppose my reason for asking you to join me was my first experience with you was not only as a fan watching rugby and stuff, but to meet you there a couple of years ago, and the fact that our partners are all integrated in terms of families and in-laws and all that stuff. We call ourselves the non-bloods, which is great. So, I wanted to get you on board and just to kind of share your story of your career to date, your kind of the work that you've done both on and off the pitch. And to kick it off, right, I'm starting it with a tricky question, but to kick it off, life for you has evolved as a sports star, family, you're a coach as well. And I'd love to know, today, for Toby Flood today, what motivates you or what inspires you, and ultimately what makes you tick?
Yeah, that's almost like an impossible question to answer, I suppose, because I think I've found that motivation evolves over time. So I think it ebbs and flows depending on circumstance to a point. So I think that what motivates you massively now is sort of protecting and caring for loved ones more than anything else. And I think then that drives you to, that then becomes quite a complex battle, because ultimately, from my point of view, I was always driven by success to a point, but doing the best for teammates and people and ultimately, I think sportsmen are quite selfish in that matter. When you have a family, when those relationships evolve and deepen, I think you become less selfish to a point. I think you become more socially aware about the requirements and what is needed of you within that remit. And I think that I found certainly that the change of, or the evolution of motivation has come or manifested itself in that desire to sort of protect and look after loved ones and those people that you sort of hold dear.
Interesting. Yeah. It's in terms of characteristic, would you say that the Toby of 22 is very different to the Toby of 30 odd?
Mate, unrecognizable, like unbelievably selfish, ruthless, difficult to manage. Like I would have been awful, like truly awful, I think, as a human being if I saw myself now. I think you become more empathetic. I think that was the sort of the evolution of probably having to run teams and lead teams, you know, when you were captain and all that sort of stuff, you had to actually have a deepening understanding of the people and how they worked around you and how to get the best out of people. I think as a young player, you are in it. Not, it's unfair, actually, it's unfair to say you're in it for yourself, but you understand that this is sort of make or break. You're willing to give up potential relationships, whether that be with friends, family, or whoever, because you're that driven to succeed. And I think that that is not necessarily the most wonderful trait in the world. At the same time, it is probably the most important trait for a sportsman, is the willingness and the openness to sacrifice. And that's either yourself or those around you is pretty fundamental. I think you can do it in a better way than I did when I was a young man. I think I was probably quite surly and quite difficult and was probably quite a spiky character. I think you evolve. I think you sort of understand that you maybe have to have an awareness of the people around you, and as your sort of relationships deepen within a system or within a squad or within an external environment, I think you understand that you probably need to not necessarily change, but soften parts of your own personality.
So do you think if you did that though, that you would have been 60 capped international?
If I hadn't changed.
If you had applied, say, what you've learned now.
Oh, I see. No, I think I became, I think I'm still very competitive, and I think if you speak to anyone in the friends circuit, I am hugely competitive, but I think you become more, do you know, I don't know if it's a really good question. I don't know if it's part of what you've achieved now when you sit back and you look back and go, oh, you know, that was all right. And so I can soften because whatever, but actually I was speaking to an ex-hockey international, recently, a lady called Purdy, and she sort of hinted at the fact she had a chip on her shoulder too, because she'd go to the Olympics. And I think you still have those chips throughout your career. And I think that actually is probably what drives you. Well, it certainly drove me as a younger man, was a desire to prove people wrong. Because I was sort of often told, I came from very simple school. I was often told that I would never make it. And I think I was often told that, you know, you're too this, you're too that, there's no opportunity there. So then it becomes a conversation or an internal dialogue, I think, that you just drive to get yourself out and actually prove it wrong. And that is it's a hot flame, right? But it's a flame that can only burn for so long. And I think you still carry chips and you carry grudges and all that sort of stuff to a point. But after that time, I think then you need to find something more fundamentally important to your characteristics that will push you forward. And I think that for me was understanding the nature of why I sacrificed, was not to prove people wrong all the time, but was to grow and develop in an organization or a team and to create sort of stronger relationships amongst your peers.
So you spoke there about leadership and getting to know the people that you are leading. What type of kind of leadership style have you got? Because some people are very, I remember hearing a story about Joe Schmidt when he'd go into the Irish dressing room and he'd shake the hands of everybody in the dressing room, you know, and make that connection. What's your style?
I think it would have been, you know, fairly tough and fairly ruthless to begin with, because that's all I knew. And I think over time, and I think you again, a bit like your career, you evolve a little bit and you become much more empathetic. So I think when I started doing it at Newcastle the second time around, when I was, I don't know, 32, 33, I think you were much softer and much calmer. Don't get me wrong, in the heat of the battle, you speak to any lads there, I can get annoyed and get frustrated and talk and get pretty ruthless. But at the same time, I don't then not expect that back to me. I'm not going to hold it against someone for speaking to me in that manner. But off the field, away from that intense stuff, I think there is that ability to want to create a rapport, understand the environment you're in and people you're talking to. You then actually can screw a little bit more out of them. But there definitely were times, you know, and I think also the hardest thing I found is to try and extract your personal issues away from, you know, from the interactions on the field. So if you're suffering off the field for whatever reason, let's say when I was leaving, I was left Leicester and I went to Toulouse, and that was quite an emotive time. And then I went on the field and then something happened and it might be flicked a switch. And rather than that, you can't take those 6 seconds that you can do in a boardroom or an office to sit and go, okay, hold on a minute, too deep breath, here we go. Because you're actually making a decision in the heat of the moment. And then you actually probably see the bad characteristics and the bad traits of who you are when you react and you flare up. And it is who you are. You can't hide it all the time. But I think when you're in control and you feel pretty strong, you can see it in all sports people, right? When they kick up and they get really frustrated, annoyed, you can see that sort of emotive reaction. Whereas I think guys who seem to be in control actually manage the situation and it almost looks effortless in terms of what they're doing.
So tell me about that. Like, when can you remember a time that you reacted, that you were like, oh,
Massive.
shit,
Yeah. So
shouldn't have done that?
here's an example of what not to do. So I caught a very simple play with a guy called Longavilla Monopola, who's about 26 stone, right? And he didn't run the right line in Leicester. And I was carrying, and I was going, right, okay, so run the line. No, he hasn't. And I got absolutely obliterated by someone, like just like cut winded, horrific, like chopped off my feet, threw me backwards. And I stood up and I went at him. Like, what am I thinking? Like, what am I, if he even has a bad reaction to me, he's just going to knock me out there and then, right? So like, I was done. Either way, I was like, I was winded. Even if it was like a 2-year-old child, I wasn't going to be able to beat them up because they would just push me over. I was like, that kid. And then Longo just stands there and just like, and I looked at me and I looked at him. And I look, I had to go reach out to him after the game and try and make it better. He then actually came to Newcastle anyway. So we ended up being friends. But, well, we always were. But, you know, it's that sort of speed of thought or that, or the inability to think, right? It's that sort of, that monkey side of your brain, to put it a better way, that, you know, as people have referenced, that just makes you react that way. And it's like, what are you doing? And, you know, and then I think that sort of, most of the time you can control it, most of the time you can orchestrate it, but I think then it shows a true sort of frustration of I've asked you to do something really simple, like trivial stuff. You've not done it. I'm the one who ends up looking an idiot, and I'm hurting. I'm going to go at you for that, right? So that is probably part of your leadership as well, right? You have to probably draw a line. Maybe not against Longo, who's 28 stone and can rip your head off
But it isn't
somewhere.
that interesting though, because he probably knew that he let you down in not running that line, right? Or
Right.
in a way maybe he didn't hear it, whatever. There was whatever was going on in his head. And when you see a leader react, like so here's the thing I find interesting in business and stuff, is that some people who are in business and who lead in business, right? They think that everybody should have the same emotion and the same kind of interest that they have, right? And the same desire, because it's their business and it's their kind of focal point, right? But people don't, right? And everybody has their own kind of view and their own kind of approach on how to do a task. If it was as simple as a communication error with you and Vinopola, was it? Yeah. So
Monopola, along Monopola,
Monopolo. But like, if it was the same, if it was a communication issue, then you can work on it. But the fact that he just didn't know it or didn't do what he was told to do, I'm sure there's a part of, I know I've been there, I've played with Johnny Sexton, and I've played where he's lifted me out of it for doing something wrong. But even if I did it right and it didn't go off, he would have still lifted me out of it, you
No, but I
know?
think you've hit the nail on the head, right? Because it then goes you it go then goes to he didn't know it, right? So the fact that he doesn't know it means that he's not working as hard as I am, and or doesn't care as much as I do, right? And then that then contextually, right, goes to business, I think, really well, in the sense that I'm doing my MBA at the moment at Cambridge, and you sit there with some of the cleverest people I've ever been in contact with, right? It's like I sit in the back and wave and look at the ceiling, I don't know what I'm doing. But these guys are like, you know, it's ridiculous. Some of these, you know, guys have, you know, all sorts of stuff. But the point being is they then struggle with this because it could be their baby, right? It could be somebody who started a unicorn. There's a couple of guys running like plane leasing companies, all this sort of stuff. It's mad, right? But they don't quite understand because it's so precious to them. And I think that's the same to a fly half, to a point in rugby, is you're so invested in the high spec detail because it's what makes you tick, because it's what who you are, and your remit is to control all facets of the game. Right? We'd have like at Leicester at certain times, a bit like Joe Schmidt would have done at Leinster in Ireland. We'd have five or six phases organized. We'd know that Stephen would be there on the fourth phase, right? He'd be third defender out. We're running a play over him because that's where, you know, he struggles to drop on his left shoulder and make that tackle, whatever it is, right? And because I knew exactly where everyone was for every single play. Now, that might not be the best, most fluid way to play rugby, but that was the way we played it sometimes at the time, certainly from set piece. And that's the way that Ireland play it to a point as well at the moment. And I think when you're invested and when you're so reliant on people behaving in that manner, a bit like a business owner, it is quite hard to realize, well, what's their motivation if they're not there, right? What's their what? Why don't they care as much as I do? And it might not be that. It might be something different. It might just be they forgot. But it sits with you very differently when it is
Yeah.
your process.
I think there's it's quite interesting in terms of I do a bit of work with athletes, and what's interesting is that every time the athlete is transitioning into the business world or trying to get into a professional world that isn't sport, right, they go in with this kind of timid kind of approach. What can I offer? What can I bring to the table? And I've always said to them is that the biggest thing that you bring to the table is your high performance ability to perform at a high level and to have done that over a number of years. Because what a lot of people are doing in the business world is they're sitting at desks. They've never performed at a high performance physically. They may mentally be able to push their businesses, but they haven't performed physically. And I think that's where athletes can come in. They've got good discipline, good kind of habits, all these type of things that are really, really important for business and for you to succeed. And I think it's interesting you're in that transition period, right, where you're going into the NBA world. What are the kind of the, like, do you go into that world kind of thinking, fuck it, what am I going to offer this crew? Or do you go in backing yourself knowing that you've performed at the highest level in sport? So there's obviously, like, there's a number of things that you can bring to a table that nobody else is bringing within this whole world of business that you're involved in.
I think it's the former more than the latter. And I think for others, it's, you know, the people around you, their perspective, it's the latter behind the former. So I think it's probably more than the former than the latter, because I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think sports people are highly driven and potentially highly selfish. But what we are, especially in team sports, certainly from my, but you don't put your head above the parapet, right? You are, no one's bigger than the team. You sit within the team, and actually the joy of it is because you don't need to, because if you perform on the weekend, everyone gets to see it anyway, right? So that, and there isn't really that in business world, right? You might IPO, you might leverage yourself and get headhunted, but actually you have that joy of just being seen on the weekend, right? And it, good or bad, everyone knows how you played, right? So there is that weird pivot for sports people to actually put your hand up and go, no, by the way, I'm really good at this stuff. Like, let me show you. But then there's that hesitancy from business, I think, certainly as I'm making this transition, that they go, well, yeah, no, I get that bit, but why can't you do this? And so I'm like, well, I will be able to do that, but give me 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, whatever it is, to get the technical proficiency up. And I think then the difference is when you then put your hand up and try and, you know, say something in a lecture, which is already terrifying, that people sort of do listen because you have done certain things. We've got a Navy SEAL on our course, right? An ex-Navy SEAL. So again, when he raises his hand, he says something, people listen because, you know, he's seen everything.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the hardest thing of a team sport is you have individuals who potentially are outliers and certain people within rugby, or, you know, take Peterson and cricket, who put himself out there. But you have to be so good for such a long time for you to survive. And if you're not good, you're gone, because the team just doesn't suffer you. And I think that's one of the hardest things for sportsmen as you transition into the real world is, well, I shouldn't say the real world, into the corporate world is, is actually, I get told off for saying that. It's like Boy Meets World, right?
This is a step into the head of Toby Flood.
Yeah, exactly. What was her name? Like, called Topanga. She was called Topanga, wasn't she? What a great name. What a great name. Anyway.
So come here. Let's just talk about the rugby aspect of things, right? Because you've played in some of the greatest teams of all time, right? Or with some of the greatest players of all time, right? And how were you able to? So part of your story, when we were at your testimonial, one of the speakers was Johnny, right? Johnny Wilkinson, right? And you guys competed massively with one another for the English shirt. And to the tail end of your career, you were competing with Owen Farrell as well for the jersey, right? But yourself and Johnny became pals, and he spoke very, very eloquently at your testimonial. How were you able to compartmentalize the fact that he was a pal as well as your competitor?
Yeah, I never saw it as that, right? It's the weirdest thing, because such a good bloke, and I think that's what you want, right? So that's the thing that sort of it disturbs the psyche a bit, right? And like you hold him in reverence as well, right? That he's Johnny Wilkinson. So when I first joined Newcastle, so like, he's just won the World Cup, right? So you sort of, you know, he's a legend. And I think beyond that as well, when the legend becomes just a normal bloke willing to give up time to help you and help your development. So we used to go kicking for hours and hours and hours when I was growing up. I mean, like, how good is that, right? It's like that wonderful advert I saw the other day of Rory McIlroy when he gets to play with Tiger Woods, right? And he's gone all for that stuff. I kind of had the similar thing, you know. Rory McIlroy was a lot better at golf and probably rugby than I ever was, but you know, the reference is there to a point. And I think that for me is like, so therefore, when he just turns out to be a good bloke, then it's like, well, actually, then, well, I'm just competing with you. And you played so long together. So, okay. So like, there was never any animosity, right? So there was never any issue to try and drive past him. You know, that chip on my shoulder I talked about earlier, like, I never had that with him. I was like, oh, I've got to need to prove Johnny wrong or that I'm better than him, or that sort of stuff. It was just an evolution because he was so generous and helpful, right? He sort of dispelled that desire to get past him to a point. You wanted to, of course, but it wasn't that you were desperately trying to rub his head in the ground, right? So I think there's two ways to do it. So then I think that for me is a real positive, because then actually when it came to me playing and on occasion when I did get picked ahead of him for England, you know, the infrequent times, right? He's the first guy to shake your hand and say, mate, well done. Like, all the best. If you need anything, I'm here, right? And I think you take a huge amount from that. So then when you go to, as you get older and then Owen comes in, you're playing ahead of Owen, you get dropped, Owen starts, all that sort of stuff. You're the first person to go to him and say, mate, anything you would need, whatever, right? And I think that's what you try and do. I think you try and take those lessons, right? Because ultimately the long-term goal is, and it's hard to, for a young boy, as we talked about before, having a chip on his shoulder to think that actually the world's against me, I must fight against the world. Fundamentally, the game's against yourself, right? It's only you that's in control. You can decide to stay there and do the extra hours, or you can't. Or you can go inside and have a social night out or whatever. Or you can think, actually, I can only control what I control. Of course, there's bounces of luck and there's moments of a fortune in rugby, and coaches might prefer you or not prefer you, but actually it only comes down to yourself at the end. And it takes a long time, I think, well, certainly did for me, for sportsmen to see that, because the fight to get there is pretty tough, and then the fight to prove people wrong is pretty tough, or certainly was in my eyes. And then actually you're still fighting and thrashing around to the age of 23 or 26 or whatever it may be, and then you realize, actually, I can only control the controllables. Let's just calm down and let's sit with that.
Yeah, it's a lot to, it's a good kind of quality to learn, isn't it? That probably going into it, you're going, okay, Johnny is a superstar, but you're going in going, like, he's got the position ahead of me. How the fuck am I going to beat him? And all of a sudden, then he diffuses any potential anxiety or stress or worry that you had going into that, to be, right, we're teammates, mate. Let's go and train together. Let's work together. Let's make each other better. That's a total different mindset and a total shift in thought from the competitor to teammate.
Yeah.
And I think if you were able to do that at such a young age, then obviously stood to you. And I presume then, as a coach now, because you're coaching in Cambridge, right? Do you apply that same principle to your team and to the lads that you work with?
Yeah, massively. So I think what I learned a huge amount was that is to take the pressure away from the players, because ultimately they have to deal with it on the weekend, right? The night before the game, their stomachs are going, they're going. So my role as a coach is to alleviate all the pressure. So if we're struggling with kicking or we're struggling with skill set or whatever, then it says, okay, so how do we get better, right? So we sit there and we talk about it. And then I think you try and go, okay, well, look, my role is to do this. Okay, so my role is to make it better. You don't worry about it. I'll put something in place. And I promise you, by the time we've got 3 weeks, 4 weeks, we'll be better anyway. So it, especially with goalkeeping, which is such a closed skill and can be impacted massively by thought processes. In fact, goalkeeping is no different than golf to a point, in terms of it's probably 85, 90% mindset. If you believe it's going to go over whatever, it's probably going to go over. So actually, those boys are so proficient, it's taken away that skill set. So you play games with them, you try and make them play games where they kick a ball and they're not allowed to look at it, and you say, well, where's that gone? How's that feeling, right? And so all we care about is big picture stuff. Because I think if you get, I especially had that in my career, sort of 2011, maybe onwards, for about a couple of years, where I was just terrified of kicking a ball, right, in a game and stuff. Just didn't want to do it. Want anything but to kick a ball, because it was just... it just meant everything was about me, right? And I really struggle with that. So I think then that is part. So then you're sort of trying to manage that, and then you get a penalty, you get the advantage. You're like, oh, we have to score a try here. Like, we've got to do something so we don't have to kick a goal. And I think then you learn how to manage that and deal with that. Right? So those experiences then come through when you coach the lads at Cambridge or at Newcastle, where I was previously, because, you know, it's the sort of knowledge and the sort of trauma or drama that you've gone through. And so that's kind of what coaching is. It's trying to impart and leave a little bit of knowledge to help those boys sort of grow in that context.
Yeah, and let me talk to you then about setbacks and injuries and the likes, right? Because you had a few, unfortunately. I think it was a 2009 semi-final.
8-9, I think. Yeah, did my Achilles.
2008, yeah, your Achilles in the semi-final. And you weren't able to play the final against Leinster. I would have liked you to play that final now and put it up to them. But so like injuries, they're setbacks, but they're massive opportunities to grow, right? Because like I don't think anybody in a dark time has looked back at it and gone, Jesus, I didn't learn anything there. You know, I think there's learning in every time. It's tough. And I think I've always said with injuries that they're character testers. They to test your resolve, to test your character, to see how you go. And you definitely go through the grieving stage and you go through that whole model of angry and denial and all that stuff, right? Unfortunately, you've had another recent injury now as well, last November. How do you cope with injuries? And now that you're actually rehabbing and going through that whole process again, like a little bit older, obviously, but what's your mindset at, and have you built up any kind of tools to help you cope?
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head. Like, it's anger to begin with, right? It's frustration, it's annoyance. I was chatting to, you know, they're on name drop, but like, you know, Sam Warburton the other day, was Toulouse in town. We did a bit of TV, you know, he's really good at it. I just sat again, like in the NBA at the background, waving at Sam Warburton how good he is. But, you know, we're laughing about this sort of mindset. Like, you get the injury, you're like, nah, and you talk about cycles. Like, I'm not, the rugby's done. Like, I hate it. I don't want to get involved in the blah, blah, blah. And we're laughing that, you know, I came out of the boot. I've started walking about 10 days ago, can get on a bike. Nearly can drive, right? You're like, oh, maybe I can make it back. Maybe, you know, 25th of March, isn't that too far? Is that not too far away, right? So you try and kid yourself as well a little bit. And actually, I think that's part of the mindset of a sporter, but also the mindset of people is that tool set you're talking about, is you have to give yourself a goal, right? So I've kind of just drifted for 4 weeks, right? But just suddenly I've had a clink of, there's a bit of hope here.
Okay.
Right. There's not, right? Well, fundamentally, there's not, but there might be, right? There might be. So there might. So I'm going to go for it. So it's this weird thing where this mental shift kicks in, where I think your toolkit is put something in a diary or put a goal. By this day, I need to be doing this, right? And if you can't, fine. But then have something fallback of, you know, there's almost like a tiered effect of, if I'm not doing that by this day, but look back on how good I am and how much I've achieved. And I think for me, that the dealing with frustration, the dealing with rehab, It certainly now, with when I don't have a game to get back to, when it's just an endless stretch of forever, right? It's not like I did it in 2008 and I was trying to make the Autumn Internationals. So there's that drive. Whereas actually, I think from your point of view, or from my point of view, it's just trying to give yourself goals and then check on them. There's some ridiculous stat that whichever people write goals in life are normally the high achievers, because there's a reference point, right? They don't drift for another 3 or 4 months and look at it and go, oh, yeah, I'm all right. I'm okay. Things are okay. I think that, and that's the hardest or the most important thing, I think, from rehab is I can kind of walk around, but actually I can't quite do a heel raise. So my goal is now, in 10 days time, I can do a full heel raise. That's my goal, right? So then it goes in full rehab, which means if I can do a full heel raise, like I was just jogging around outside a tiny bit, if I can do a full heel raise, then I can do a run. Then I can, yeah, so it's just that build. And I think that's how you have to do it. Because if you go right to the end point and go, on the 24th of March, I want to be running out of Twickenham, you lost.
Just give a bit of context on what the injury was as well, because like you're talking about a heel raise, like you didn't just go over on your ankle, like.
You know, the doctor described it as a proper good go, I think, is what they said. So I a minute into the steel bodger match, which is traditionally a big match for Cambridge and stuff, and 6,000 or 7,000 people there, which is huge for the university, I lasted 1.5 minutes, which was pretty good. Went to a ruck, and this guy hit me and my leg just went. So all his weight went through my ankle. My ankle was dislocated and fractured and all that sort of stuff. And I had sort of, I think that stupid moment of like looking down, you're like, I can solve this problem as it's pointing out to the right. So I just grabbed it and put it back in. Oh.
It's initial, your initial reaction.
His reaction was like, oh, this will be fine. Just put it back in. And so I like clipped it back in. And then people are like, why do that? I was like, I don't know. Like, I think you just get this, like, the panic just kicks in. You're like, right, we're getting nice. So, but you, it's weird though, right? So I've only done two big ones. So 2008 when I did my Achilles, and then this one. And it's weird how you know. Like, you just, it's the oddest thing. So I remember sort of, it's that, I remember thinking that Martin Williams had kicked me in the back of the heel when I was playing in that semi-final, because he was playing for Cardiff at the time. And he loved a little niggle at a fly half or whatever. And I thought, oh, he must have hit me. So I turned around and went, you mother fuck. And then I literally get the fucker out because he wasn't there. And I realised my Achilles gone pop.
Oh, wow.
And it's the same with this one, the rock. Like, you just know, you just get hit and it goes, right? And I'm sure your body feels it, right? I mean, I had no... But it's just like you pull yourself out of the rock and you're like, it's gone, it's gone, it's gone. You look down and it's like, oh. And it's, so yeah, it's weird, right? It resonates pretty quickly and pretty fast. That the sort of, and I think that's when it dawned on you, especially that was the darkest bit where you're on the field for like 9, 10 minutes trying to get you off.
Yeah.
They're like, that's it. Like, there's no coming back from this. This is you absolutely done. And then, as I said before, it's, and then that thought thing goes, actually, I can.
It's interesting. It's interesting you talk about we were talking about the process and the kind of the anger, denial, and stuff. So there's there's a grieving model. It's an 8-step in psychology. Yeah. There's 8 steps to it. And you're probably aware of it, but it's the same grieving process and model that you go through if somebody dies that's close to you, right?
Yeah.
And so you kind of have to go through those. But then you're talking about you were talking there about 4 weeks where you were aimlessly kind of floating, right?
Mm.
I think a lot of athletes, when they finish sport or when they don't have a purpose to focus on something, that's when you get a little bit lost, right? So you had a purpose after 2008 to get to the Ottawa Internationals, right? Mm. What's your purpose now? The purpose, and it's probably defining that purpose, because having a purpose means you do the rehab properly, you go through all the steps properly, and essentially with your young family now, like, ultimately the purpose, or maybe a purpose, is to know that you can run around with those, with your kids, without having to worry about your ankle ever again, do you know? So I'm going to do all the rehab and all the elements that I need to focus on right now,
right?
And then 10, 15 years time, it becomes a distant memory of and a laugh about, as opposed to something that'll always be at you, you know?
Yeah, no, you're dead right. You know, but the only issue is, you know, running around and kicking a ball in your garden with your kids is not like having Ma Nonna running down at you, right? So the quality of rehab maybe isn't that big.
Give it time.
Yeah, exactly.
You never know.
I'm going to feed him so many drugs just to be as big as Ma Nonna. That's the plan. But, you know, just get him massive. And but no, yeah, I think the thing is, it's exactly that. It's just context, right? And I think the context is the most important bit. And that's all I've ever said to the doctors. Look, one of the doctors said to me, they're not called doctors, are they, surgeons? They're called Mr., which throws me anyway. But he was like, you might not be able to run again. And I was like, oh, okay, great. And so then that's like, then that chip comes back on. It's like, right, you see, like, that wounds you in that grieving stage. And then now you're on that stairs and you're doing some leg raises and some heel raises. You're like, okay, no, I can do this, right? I can get there.
Yeah.
I can run. So, and you know, he's wonderful. He's really kind. He, at post-op, after, you know, 4 weeks, said, look, it's looking pretty good. You should be okay. But that chip kicks in again, right? Which is, you know, I want to prove someone wrong again, right? So it only lasts a certain amount of time. But yeah, and you say the bigger picture is kids and all that sort of stuff, right?
Isn't it brilliant though that you naturally tap into that competitor that's there?
Mm.
That's that young fella. It's mad, isn't it? Tell me I can't do something. You said that in, like, when you were starting off, you were told you couldn't do this, you won't do that. And all of a sudden you're going, I prove you wrong.
It's not good when you play cards at Christmas, mate. I'll tell you that much. But,
but come here, let's talk a little bit about family as well. And I think it's important to talk about this. You're an ambassador for a wonderful foundation and charity called Tommy's, right?
Mm.
And like, what people don't get to see is the person off outside the pitch and the person that's behind closed doors. And you mentioned it a minute ago about players. Like, there's things that goes on behind the scenes that you don't know. Like, we're not like, players aren't robots, right? So each week you can't expect them to just come in and perform, because you don't know what all the other things that are going on behind the scenes, whether it's family relationships, whatever. But when we're at the testimonial for you, I learned about Tommy's, but I'd love if you wouldn't mind sharing your story, if you don't mind, and how Tommy's came about with you, because I think it's one of those stories that will touch people, will move people, but will also give people hope.
Yeah, look, I'm more than happy. I mean, yeah, so part of Tommy's, I think we moved to France in sort of 2014, and we went there and we'd sort of been trying a little bit to conceive, and it sort of had sort of worked, hadn't sort of worked, that sort of stuff. And then went there, and then we sort of tried again, and actually we sort of quite successful. We sort of realized we needed a little bit of help, so we had some the cells took some injections, and we ended up having actually having sort of successful with three embryos, right? So wasn't IVF, it was insemination, but it was a step on that sort of curve towards IVF that we thought potentially we might have to go down. Then we had a reduction, which is quite traumatic in itself, right? You've sort of waited sort of 2.5, well, not 2.5, but let's say 1.5, 2.5 years, whatever it might be, to sort of to get that goal. You have three, you have to remove one. And then we went away on what was supposed to be our sort of last big holiday before they arrived. And it was sort of like maybe like, 19 weeks, 20, 21 weeks, something like that. And we landed in Kuala Lumpur within sort of 16 hours, we'd lost both, and that was it, right? So we were just, it was pretty traumatic. You have to go with that experience. You have to sort of ring people and tell people, and to your sort of head, you're in a whirlwind. You have to try and organize flights home, which was pretty difficult, and all that sort of stuff. And I think then you sort of you go back into that, I suppose, that sort of goal mode, right? Is that grieving stage? And we did grieve for about maybe I don't know. 2, 3 months, maybe, if not more. I remember doing a massive walk, and sort of we brought the ashes back and we said goodbye and all that sort of stuff. Because I think it's sort of when you've worked so hard or you've thought so hard much about it, and I think it's a lot worse for the women involved in it, because there's that constant hope, right? There's like that the cycle of the menstrual cycle is that constant hope of maybe, maybe, maybe. And if you skip a day or miss a day, and then suddenly there's that, but as a man, you're sort of sitting there crossing your fingers, so you're sort of a bit of a bystander. And so we went through that whole process, and eventually we conceived again through insemination with our first, who's now sort of 6, 6.5, and then we had another one in the UK, again through insemination. And then actually we were kind of like, that's not bad, but pretty good. And we can't conceive naturally, right? And then so we went on holiday, went to Thailand, and with these two lovely kids, etc. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, our third turned up, right? So I'm still questioning his heritage a little bit. Still canvassing, well, who else was on holiday and stuff. But like, this couldn't happen naturally. But I think that's probably that psychological bit where you're sort of a bit more relaxed and things are different, and it's easier to say from afar. But I think the one thing I've learned, especially with working with Tommy's, is we don't like talk about it much, right? Like, there are 4.5 years between me and my sister. There's like my wife's family, there's 9 years between her sister, her brother, and herself, right? There's three of them. So they've obviously had, but I'm, and my mother-in-law's pretty often, we'll talk about this, but there's often bumps in the road, right? But us Brits, certainly, I don't want to include the Irish in sort of sweeping generalization, but like we're pretty stoic and we just get on with it, right? Stiff upper lip stuff, we don't talk about it. But the more I vocalize it, the more people go, oh, yeah, it happened to us, we lost this, we lost that, right? So, and I think that's it's important to sort of share the stories, because I think maybe the generation prior to us were less willing to do so and probably more conscious of what society would think, right? Whereas I think we're in an era now, you don't want to be shouting from the rooftops, but sharing amongst people and trying to drive the work that Tommy's doing of sort of reducing the risk of pregnancy is massively important. But and don't get me wrong, I'd rather have just kept this in-house in terms of, my great family, but it also resonates the importance of sharing those stories, that you're not alone, and actually it happens all the time, and people have crap moments all the time, and it's tough, right? And it's that tricky thing of, your school teachers tell you don't have sex with unprotected sex at the age of 13, 14, because you'll definitely fall pregnant, right? Maybe not, right? So it's that it just goes, right? And maybe when you were 13, 14, maybe you would, right? But
Jesus, you start young over there, don't
apparently
you?
that's apparently it's illegal. Weird. But like it's but I think sort of that thing, maybe you would, but I think when you're older you get, and because we're having babies later, because careers are sort of part and parcel of our of sort of modern life, it does make things more tricky.
Tell me though, so with that, how was your how did you cope with your relationship then as well? Because that's also part and parcel of the whole thing, right? And that, like, it's you both want the same outcome, but like you've been through a massive trauma, in losing the kids to get the kind of the as a team then to say, right, let's go again. Like, how did your relationship manage over that time? Because
I think I became, you know, mate, you've met my wife, I'm often the passenger, but I think I became very much the passenger in that relationship, in the sense that, because I, you know, I hadn't gone through the trauma, right? I'd seen it. It had been horrific from my point of view to, you know, Sally had to give birth. So that was pretty rough, but that's rough in inverted commas for me, but not compared to what she went through, right? So then actually you become very much the sort of facilitator again, right? You're that kind of almost that coach role where you're sort of going, well, okay, like, how do you feel about it? Do you want to do that? No. And then you step back and you let it sit. And then you're just sort of having gentle conversations about, and I think Sal, from my point of view, was adamant, right? We landed, we came back, we went away on holiday, and we landed back in France. We took 10 days in sort of a place in the mountains up by sort of in the Pyrenees. And we just sort of sat, right? We sat by the pool, we ate, we drank. Some people came to visit us who we knew in Toulouse for a couple of days. And then, you know, it's just sort of that process of just sort of finding your feet again. But then she was in very much charge, right? So she was adamant she wanted to go again. She was over it. She was pretty good. She was very, really strong. And look, she was right, because we had our first child. But I think as that dynamic is, one of you has to take the lead. And I think it's right that she did. And I just sort of sat there and just was a bit of a crutch, really, more than anything else. And just because I was obviously, as you say, the aligned goal was that we had a sorry, we had an aligned goal, sorry. And I think that part is, as a sort of part of that, as you go, you let someone sort of drive you towards that.
Yeah, and like I love the fact that you're talking that you said that you would have preferred to have kept it in house, but the fact that you shared it, you've known that, like that your story has given people a bit of hope, right? And with there's a Carl Rogers who's a and I've quoted a couple of times, but he's a great philosopher, right? Or was a great philosopher, and he's saying what's personal is universal. And when you actually share something that's going through, whether it's anxiety or whether it's trying to have a bit, have create a family or whether it's depression or whether it's anything like that, when you do speak about it, you might realize that you're not on your own and that there's ways to help. How have you found the like with Tommy's the work that they do? Can you just kind of nearly explain a little bit what they do? Because it's essentially, I don't think Tommy's will be well known in Ireland, but with everybody who's in the UK, maybe knows them a little bit better. But specifically, how do they help?
So Tommy's a sort of a research-based charity that we're trying or trying to reduce all miscarriages or premature baby deaths. So that's basically what they're about in a nutshell. Obviously, they do a lot more than that, but that's what they're there's an entity. So they've spent millions on trying to sort of lower the risk of pregnancies and increase the likelihood of children, you know, surviving. And not only that, they then offer now, because it still occurs now, I guess their wish is one day they don't have to do this, but they offer counseling and care, right, to people who have gone through the issues that I have gone through or others will go through. So they're a sort of an incredible charity to help you over that period and sort of realize your goals. And also, they, you know, if things become tough and you are a candidate, they obviously will pay for procedures as well. So they're an incredible outfit, right?
Oh,
So they
wow.
are, you know, they're an impressive entity. I think they're an organization to which you should be, well, I think we're very grateful to have that connection, because, you know, through the work you do, you sort of feel as though you're helping for that sort of, so it doesn't happen to anyone else.
Brilliant, brilliant. Well, I'll put a link into the show notes and all that stuff, and we'll see
Thank you.
if anybody wants to kind of follow up on that. Let's kind of just talk a little bit about. I ask everybody on the pod about like. So you've got three wonderful kids, right? If you were to leave a message now, behind to your loved ones, right? From all the life that you've created and all the madness that you've been through. And like we haven't spoken about any of
No,
that really.
we
But
haven't.
no, but we're like, what would you say? Like, how would you like to be remembered, man? How would you like to be seen?
I think you have I don't know, I think you have a perception of how you want to be seen, and it's not quite what the rest of the world sees. I think that's the most important thing. I think you want to be seen as a decent person, right? But at the same time, you know, we've talked to some of the competitive nature that I think you want your kids to, well, I certainly want my kids to fight, right? I don't mean that. I'm not asking them to
Fight for
play.
what they want, though, yeah.
Right. I'm not asking them to fight and, you know, kick the crap out of James in the schoolyard or whatever, right? Like, I can live with that. I know from the fact we haven't got much fighting pedigree in this family, but what I'm saying is more about the exactly for fight for what they want, right? And to not give up, right? And I think the biggest lesson for me is that sort of that Ray Dalio, you know, the huge whatever billionaire hedge fund, but he's a flat hierarchy in his organization. It's about failure, right? So he wants people to fail, and he wants to be able to feedback. So I think for me, it's to remove that fear of failure. So my one message I think would be to the kids would be to, as you say, fight for what you want, but don't be scared to fail, because you're going to fail all the time. It's just part of who you are. It's part of growing up. And I think had I probably been less scared of failing when I was younger, then I think you'd take more risks. Now, does that mean you might get some inches in the column, you know, in a rugby thing when you're 22 that is pretty aggressive and pretty horrible, rather than taking the safe option that we won the game, whatever, just about, or we had a crack? So I think that sort of risk reward basis, and you want your kids to, it's a long-winded way of saying you want your kids to have a crack, right? You want your kids to properly go for it, whatever their passion is, whatever they want to do. It's like, don't worry about the negative stuff. Just go positive and stay as positive as possible.
Yeah, I love it, man. I love it. It's funny. You see kids who are playing in the rain, right? And you see the parents saying, get out of the puddle. Don't, like, whereas you let the kids play in the puddle, enjoy the creativity, learn that you're going to get wet, and learn that it's all going to happen. But, like, what's the worst that could happen? You get wet.
Exactly.
You'll be fine. Okay, and come here, listen, given it's a rugby year, right? It's important. It's important. Jesus, that I get the soundbite.
Show me to say that I'm going to win the World Cup.
Well, here are predictions. I have it here. Predictions. All right. So first, we'll get the Six Nations. All right. Six Nations predictions.
Yeah, I don't know is the answer, and I think this is the problem. And I'm going to properly sit on the fence. So, like I said, I do whenever I do some corporate at the moment, but because it's so hard to call, right? Mm-hmm. It's so hard that Ireland and France are the top two teams in the world at the moment, you know, down to numbers and the fact they've been hugely successful and they're really well coached and they've got some exceptional talent. But they're beatable, right?
Yeah.
So, and that's, you know, Australia lost by a point to France in France. You know, they've now got Eddie Jones. The top eight, if not 10 in world rugby, is so tight and so interesting that I genuinely think, and this is my prediction, I think England will go to Ireland, last game of the Six Nations, and they'll both be going for a Grand Slam. That's my thought process. I think Ireland have, if you look at their fixture list, which if I remember correctly, means Ireland will have a couple of big teams at home. I believe they've got France at home and they've got England at home, right?
Yeah.
And then beyond that, look, unless Gatland throws up a massive curveball, I think they're pretty comfortable. England have historically always have the Blues at home or the Blues away, right? So they have Scotland, Italy and France at home. I think, again, they might go to Wales without Gatland, in inverted commas, worry, and get a job done there, because I think it's first out. And then it's pretty comfortable. And, you know, everything's at home from that point on, or whatever it may be. So I think I'm probably getting these wrong, but I do think that France are beatable, and I think that Ireland are beatable. But I think Ireland and France, England could find themselves in a massive contest in Dublin, which would be phenomenal. Look, I could be, I'm probably wrong, right? Gatland, when he comes back, like in 2010, just wins the Grand Slam and sails off the sunset. Comes to Twickenham, and no, 2008, so he comes to Twickenham with the Ospreys and beats us. Unbelievable.
Oh, yeah. Phenomenal. But, what we'll do though is we'll get you over anyway. We have to get you over for the English game regardless in the 18th.
Exactly.
It's Paddy's weekend, you know. So it's
I know. Listen,
that,
I know it is. It's huge. It's huge.
A huge
so I think
one.
You know, it's great. It's great. And I think, you know, basically that was a long-winded way to say, I think anyone, you know, who thinks they can call it this moment in time in world rugby is daft, because it is so tight. It's so different, and everyone can beat everyone. I think it's a great time to have a World Cup. It's a great time to be involved in rugby. It's really good.
So on to the World Cup then. So like, I know we're talking about Six Nations there, but if you had to pick one, come on, you put your pin to the mast, remove emotion now.
I think, you know, I still think it's hard to look past South Africa.
Yeah.
They're custom made for World Cups, right? They're not going to play the most beautiful rugby. They're not going to set the world on fire. France, physically, can they live with them? Depending, and look, there's so many bits of going to rugby in the sense that You get a Sunday afternoon or a Saturday morning and it's hailing down with rain and it's an absolute nightmare. You're going to pick South Africa every time, right? If it's 37 degrees and potentially France are looking quite good, then maybe you go with them. So it does depend on circumstance and situation. But South Africa, world champions, still massive, and they still play a game which is unattractive, but it is a game that wins World Cups. That's why they've won so many.
And yeah,
all of you wants to go with someone else, some a more poetic. You know, France winning in France would be unbelievable, the sport in that country. But, and they probably should have the capability to do it. But it's hard to look past those big boxes.
It is. Right. Well, listen, Toby, appreciate your time, my man. The mic is yours. Let people know what's going on. What's going on in Toby Flood's life? Where should what do they need to know if they don't know it all already?
You know me. There's not much going on, mate. Yeah. Look, I think we talked before. I'm making that transition from sport to business. It's tough. It's interesting. I'm sort of stretching out the tentacles to find out what's going on there and having really good conversations with lots of people. But I think part of that is, you know, you're a bit bored. It's like, I want to do something. So the rehab's been really useful for that in that manner. But from my point of view, it's just, you know, it's probably as hard a thing as you've ever done, making that transition, if I'm honest. It's because you've gone from somewhere where you were very comfortable, you knew probably quite a lot about that industry and that environment and how to operate, and then you leave there, even if your body couldn't do it as you got older, but you knew what you were doing and knew what you're talking about. And I think it's making that transition into the unknown is super exciting, but at the same time is a little bit daunting, because you want to make that perfect leap. And you're never going to go to, right? So there's a bit of kidology going on there. You've got to try and find your way and maybe have to move once or twice until you sort of find your niche.
I think it goes back to your point about what your message is to your kids. Like, don't be afraid to fail.
Yeah,
you know, exactly. Like, again, take a bit of your own medicine there and have a go, because like, it's easy to do something that you have a passion for, which was rugby for so long, right? And now it's to try and reignite a new passion, whatever that's going to be. But at least you're trying to figure that out along the way. So, come here. I appreciate your time, man. And I appreciate you sharing and being so honest. And listen, whatever happens in the future, as far as I'm concerned, like, you've had an unbelievable career. You've like, my interactions with you have only been positive, and I look forward to the next time we get a chance to share a pint together, because we're very good at that.
Sounds good, mate.
But no, I appreciate you, man.
Anytime, man. Appreciate it.
Once again, thank you for joining me on season 4 and taking part in this journey where we talk to people like you and me about what motivates them, what inspires them, and ultimately what makes them tick. I've learned so much from the various conversations I've had. I hope you can take something from this that you can apply to your life. That's why this podcast has been created. I'm very proud of it, and I'm very thankful for everybody who's joined me so far. Thank you all for listening.